From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a thing.
The secret Senate health care bill isn't secret anymore, but does it meet the Trump test of being less mean than the House bill? Plus, Democrats got their hopes up about a special election and are now doing some soul-searching. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. And our special guest is Derek Thompson, who covers economics for The Atlantic. Welcome, everybody. After much suspense, the Senate health care bill was released on Thursday, and it is similar in broad strokes to the House bill, including repealing nearly all the taxes that were imposed in Obamacare, abolishing the individual mandate, and sharply cutting Medicaid. But there are differences. The Medicaid cutbacks are delayed, though in the long run they're actually deeper than in the House bill. Subsidies to buy health insurance would be more similar to the ones that exist now under Obamacare, only smaller. And insurers would not be allowed to set prices based on pre-existing conditions, though states would get broad authority to waive other regulations in Obamacare to much the same effect. Rich, this bill would not repeal Obamacare, though it would significantly shrink it. What policy goal could Republicans truthfully say they have served if this bill becomes law?
Well, they've reduced the size of government pretty substantially through the tax cut and through the cuts in spending, somewhat deregulate the law, not a lot. Significantly reform Medicaid and put Medicaid on a footing that, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, no one would have cried bloody murder over changing the federal match and the spending formula for Medicaid, which it used to be pretty much a matter of bipartisan consensus that was badly structured and driving the program out of control. So those are accomplishments. It's just it does fall significantly short of the rhetoric of repeal and replace, and inevitably has in the short term a transition period where Obamacare continues to run on and continues to be subsidized by the federal government, and that is driving some critics on the right crazy.
Katrina, I see you smiling.
You know, no, I think in this case President Trump got it right when he called this bill. I mean, he was talking about the House version, but this is mean. This is cruel. I don't think the word accomplishment should be in proximity to this bill. I mean, the bottom line gives billionaires, millionaires massive new tax cuts by slashing health benefits for millions and taking care away from millions more. You know, in the minds of many, maybe Trump supporters, Medicaid reads poor, maybe African American, but Medicaid, I think it's 2/3 of assisted living is paid for by Medicaid. It's, you know, the largest single reduction in a social insurance program in our nation's history. So I would rank, if this goes through, as the dismantling, destructive version of the passage of Medicare and the passage of Medicaid. Those built out a more humane country. I think the Republicans will own this. There are some who speculate McConnell secretly would like his bill to fail. I hear they're circulating pages from his memoirs where he takes credit for having pushed through the ACA without a single Republican vote. The Republicans own that, and it is deeply unpopular. And moving into 2018, I think there's a lot of soul searching.
Derek, you know, the funny thing here is what Rich says about what Republicans achieved here. I think it's true that, you know, typically you would say Republicans are pleased about a bill that cuts taxes and cuts spending substantially. The weird thing is you have a Republican president right now who ran on the idea that Medicaid should not be cut and that there should be insurance for everybody.
That's right. Yeah, President Trump explicitly said on numerous occasions through Twitter that he did not want to cut Medicaid, and that is explicitly what this bill does. To Katrina's point, Medicaid now covers 64% of nursing home residents, 60% of kids with disabilities, about half of births in America, and 20% of all Americans. This is a massive program, and it would be cut severely in the long term, just as you said. You know, it's interesting. This bill is clearly bad for the low income. It's a relatively straightforward transfer of income from the poor to the rich. it also might be bad for Republicans. In fact, I think you have a lot of Democrats who think explicitly, even people who aren't necessarily Democratic partisans, thinking that Republicans are walking into a minefield with this. Opposition to Obamacare repeal is rather large. It's an extremely unpopular bill. And it's not obvious that the amendments to this, or I'm sorry, the changes to this bill are going to make it any more popular.
Rich, one refrain that we've heard from Republicans critical of Obamacare over the last 7 years or so is this idea that coverage isn't access, that health insurance, you know, if the doctor you want to go doesn't take it, then that's not effective, or if your deductible is so high that you can't afford to pay for the care that you want under your coverage, then you don't really have access. And the thing I look at this is the subsidies would be changed to be based on a plan that's less generous, basically based on a high deductible plan, and it would get rid of what are called cost sharing subsidies under the existing program, where if you have a moderately low income, say you make 200% of the poverty line, the government pays part of your deductible for you. So it seems to me that a lot of people under this plan, they would stay covered, but they'd end up with a plan that has a deductible of, you know, $5,000, $8,000. And they won't have $5,000 or $8,000 to be able to pay for care that they need. So I guess, isn't that subject even more so to that critique that coverage isn't access?
It is. In theory, you want people to have catastrophic coverage that has high deductibles because you don't want insurance to just pay for routine expenses. The problem is with lower income people, the deductibles, you point out, if it's high enough, just is tantamount not to having insurance at all. Just having to pay that $5,000 to cover your deductible is a catastrophic expense. And I'm in favor of subsidizing as much as possible people lower down the income scale within reason. And the Senate did move more in the direction than the House did. I think best critique or the most telling critique of the Senate bill as it stands is that it would significantly destabilize the individual market even more than it's destabilized now, because it would repeal the individual mandate immediately without any attempt whatsoever to create an incentive against people gaming the system and just staying off insurance until they get sick and need it again. Now, they're trying to figure out a way to grapple with that that's consistent with what the Senate parliamentarian will say is in bounds in such a reconciliation bill. But as it stands, the bill would actually make the individual health market worse than it is now.
I mean, let me sound sober before I rant. But, I mean, you know, my colleague, former colleague Chris Hayes, our former Washington editor, over at MSNBC, had a good tweet, I think this morning, just how ridiculous all of this is. I mean, in here is buried a retroactive tax cut for investment income. I mean, this is such a massive redistribution of wealth, and it's built around this need for $1 trillion, maybe more, tax cut in order to keep things revenue neutral, adhering to Grover Norquist's plea or holding Republicans accountable or he'll knock their heads off. There's nothing in here that would control runaway drug costs or challenge big pharma's greed and patent monopolies. There's no expansion of Medicare to under 65, which is a very popular idea, which has been floated by some Democratic senators, including Senator Merkley of Oregon. And there's also massive cuts in dramatic rollbacks of opioid treatment. And we've talked about that on the show. And who does that hurt disproportionately? Many of the supporters, Trump supporters. But in general, I mean, this is, you know, a dismantling of a healthcare system that isn't adequate as it is. I mean, I felt Obamacare was not adequate. We didn't get a public option in that fight. And I think, as I said last week, it's, you know, now a moment for progressives and Democrats to fight for keeping what we can, but driving Medicare for all, which, don't laugh, Rich, it's not just a left-wing fantasy. 60%, according to a YouGov poll, think they'd like to look at that and what that means. It's more efficient. It's less costly due to administrative costs. And I think it's an opening that Democrats, progressives need to fight for as we take, as we make sure that Republicans own this move, this dismantling.
It's funny, though. Derek, Katrina mentions the dismantling of the architecture of much of Obamacare here in this bill. But another thing that's in this bill that's not in the House bill is actually more to bolster the existing architecture of Obamacare over the next couple of years during that transition phase. There are these concerns about states where the individual market is, if not, you know, if not death spiraled, it is in significant disarray, often with only one insurer in various markets. And this bill includes billions of dollars essentially in insurer subsidies to try to prop those markets up. It seems to me to set up a weird political situation where you have this bill that has lots of promised deep cuts far in the future, and also has actually significant spending in the near term to try to make the existing system work. And it makes me sort of imagine that if you pass this bill and you end up in these situations where you're spending money now to try to keep things working, and then you've promised to do things that will take away insurance from people in the future, could create significant political pressure to revisit the bill within just a year or two.
I think you totally nailed it. I mean, in many ways, this is Obamacare light. Americans are getting tax credits to buy health insurance calculated by age and income. And this might be a reason why maybe some conservative senator, someone like Rand Paul, aren't going to support the bill at all. It's because it too much resembles Obamacare. And if it does pass the Senate, it'll be interesting how the Senate and the House sort of work out their differences there, because this is clearly more like Obamacare, particularly in the short term, than the House bill. But to get back to Medicaid, I mean, the cuts that are being made to this program in the long run are really rather draconian. And they're mostly mm-hmm. these cuts are coming from the fact that Medicaid funding is going to be driven by attaching it to the consumer price index, which is just going to grow more slowly. So you're going to end up cutting more and more and more from the program as you go along. And you're almost certainly, we'll see what happens when the CBO report comes out, going to be losing a lot of coverage, millions of people being covered under Medicaid in the out years. So in many ways, you could say, yeah, this is a somewhat politically ingenious plot to front load the popular stuff and backload the unpopular stuff in order to get some senators on board in the short term and say, you know, we'll deal with the unpopular stuff when that comes up in the early 2020s. But it should be said that the law as written should be evaluated as it is written. And as it is written, it is going to have mm-hmm. a massively bad effect on the Medicaid mm-hmm. population.
Rich, do you think that there's going to be meaningful resistance from the right within either the Senate or the House about those Obamacare-like aspects of this? I mean, in particular, when I look at it, you mentioned the way that it treats poor people more generously than the House bill does by leaving the insurance subsidies in a structure that's more like the structure under Obamacare. It seems to me like one of the key reasons that Paul Ryan really wanted big changes to the healthcare market was his concern about what he discusses as poverty traps, which is basically this idea that if you give people a subsidy that declines as their income rises, that acts like a tax and it discourages them from working, it can mean that, you know, your standard of living isn't materially higher if you make $35,000 than if you make $25,000. So doesn't this bill leave that problem in place? Isn't that a reason for the House to sort of pick a fight with the Senate over that structural matter?
I kind of think of the dissenters currently in the Senate, Rand Paul's probably a hard no. Susan Collins, we haven't heard from, wouldn't be surprise me if she's a no. So then after that, you know, you can lose two. So that those are your two, and you have no margin for error. I kind of think Ted Cruz wants to get to yes against mm-hmm. type here. He's been very involved in the process, trying to change his image a little bit. And if he gets to yes, I think Mike Lee probably goes with him. And if Mike Lee and Ted Cruz support this bill, and it passes the Senate, then it's very likely to pass the House. And I think that would lessen a lot of the Freedom Caucus opposition. So this thing is very close. You know, it might fall short. It might all fall apart. It will look very different by the end of next week, after you have the so-called Votorama process in the Senate floor, when anyone can offer any amendment on anything. So it will look different at the end of the day. But they've done the first step, which is getting a structure that the median Senate Republican is supportive of. And then you still have a handful to pick off on the right and the left. But it might not happen, but it's certainly doable.
One senator I'm watching is Dean Heller from mm-hmm, Nevada. And as we tape, and who know, by the time this airs, this may be overtaken by events, but the Republican governor of Nevada, Brian Sandoval, has been very critical of Medicaid cuts. And Heller and Sandoval are supposed to have a joint press conference later today to talk about the bill, which would be a little odd if Heller was going to say that he was going to support the bill. I don't know why I'd want to stand up there with Sandoval and talk about that, but we'll see what that is.
But you nod to some interesting coalitions that could evolve. I mean, Derek mentioned, you know, nursing homes. I mean, middle-class seniors allied with those who give birth, allied with governors, Republican governors, who are going to have to bear the brunt of Medicaid cuts in their state. They've witnessed what's happened in Kansas, where the Republicans revolted against Brownback and the draconian tax cuts. So I think heading into 2018, well, not just that, I think the August recess, though something looks like it'll be passed and McConnell was worried about holding off before then, I think we're going to see interesting political economic coalitions evolve out of this.
The polling is interesting because, you know, on the one hand, I think it's reasonable for the press to focus on the overall unpopularity of the bill, and it is indeed not popular. But actually, in the last Morning Consult poll, among Trump voters, 55% support, 27% are strongly or slightly against. So it's the bill still does seem to be popular among Republican registered voters overall. But who it's least popular among are those most likely to vote. It's older people.
Mm-hmm.
55 and above, 65
seniors.
And above.
Yeah.
I think only 9% of seniors strongly support AHCA, and this bill is much more like AHCA than it is Obamacare. That is a tiny number, and you do not want to anger that lobby when you're running in a tight 2018 race. And so it'll be really interesting to see. You know, people like to pretend the politicians are always playing 11-dimensional chess when they're really just moving pieces around a board randomly. But when it comes to McConnell, I truly believe my thesis is the McConnell mystique. I think that, you know, if it turns out that he left out parts of this bill so that individual senators could take credit for certain provisions, I would say he's a genius. If the bill doesn't pass, I'll assume it's because McConnell didn't want it to pass. I'm pretty much in the camp of assuming that whatever happens on Capitol Hill is the explicit will of the Mitch. So it'll be interesting, really interesting to see how it comes down to these individual senators, what they say on the floor and their ability to pass certain amendments that they can use as carrots when they go back to their district and explain why.
Let us know what you think about the emerging Senate health care bill on our Facebook page, or you can message us on Twitter. That's at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, Democrats soul searching. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I am Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. And Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, is also with us. On Tuesday, Republican Karen Handel won the most expensive House race in U.S. history, beating Democrat John Ossoff in an affluent district in Atlanta's northern suburbs. She won by 4 points in a district Trump had won by less than 2, but that Mitt Romney had won by 20 points 4 years earlier. This was the special election where Democrats had the highest hopes of picking up a Republican seat, and the loss has led to a lot of soul-searching. Democrats keep overperforming their benchmarks in special elections but coming up short. Does that mean they can't make up ground where it counts? Or does it mean Republicans should be nervous about next year when they'll also have to defend seats more marginal than the 4 that have come up in special elections? Republicans also ran lots of ads linking Ossoff to Nancy Pelosi, who, 15 years into her run at the head of the House Democratic Caucus, is the longest-serving party leader in the House since Sam Rayburn. Some younger members of the conference, like Kathleen Rice of New York and Seth Moulton of Massachusetts, have been agitating for her to go, saying the conference needs new blood to appeal to swing voters. Katrina, do Democrats need to change to win? And if so, what do they need to change?
So I don't want to overread the special election in Georgia. I think For All the Sound and the Fury signifies little in 2018. I was struck by Cook Political Report noted 71 congressional districts currently held by Republicans are expected to be more competitive in the 2018 midterms than Georgia's 6. Sure, disappointment, but not demoralization by any measure. And I think what Ossoff didn't do was define himself. And in the fact that he didn't define himself, it allowed the Republicans to have a clearer field. And they chose Pelosi because they've hunted her for years. I think she is a strong leader. Change will come. But it's more about the need to lay out a clear, bold agenda that connects to people's lives and show that you will improve their lives. This was a tough district. Montana was. Kansas was. So I wouldn't overread.
Derek, what do you think?
As you said, most expensive race in history, but I don't know what the election was about. It was a weirdly substance-free campaign. You know, Ossoff didn't really have an agenda. Handel didn't really embrace Trump. Ossoff didn't really tie her to Trump. Molly Ball made this point really beautifully in her coverage, Molly Ball of The Atlantic. She said Ossoff essentially ran as a blank slate. His campaign slogan, humble, kind, ready to fight. It's not a policy agenda. It's not an anti-Trump agenda. It's tofu. It's a flavorless substance whose principal benefit is just to live easily with other flavors and absorb their flavors. Like, it's just he clearly didn't run on any message that was meant to sort of appeal to people who are rabidly anti-Trump. And as a result, I think it's easy to say that he lost precisely because he didn't run a negative partisan race in a negative partisan country. I also think, though, it's worth pointing out that I think a lot of liberals are celebrating as if overperforming and in consistent defeat is similar to winning. You know, on the one hand, the overperformance is great if the midterms are happening in, say, August. That's an easy extrapolation. November 2018 is 17 months away, and that's a veritable eternity. I have no idea what's going to happen in those 17 months. But if you go back 17 months, that's February of 2016. That's the month that the RNC is disinviting National Review from its Republican debate. It's the month that we were talking about Michael Bloomberg possibly running for president and Marco Rubio being the trendy pick for the GOP presidential nomination. I mean, so many things can happen in 17 months. So I would just caution against the narrative that this isn't, that you can easily extrapolate and say, well, because Democrats are running, you know, 8 points over the partisan average, and that sort of correlates to picking up 80 seats, they're only down 47, they'll win the House. This is not an easy and an automatic extrapolation.
You're bringing back so many fond months. Memories for me.
I know.
Excuse me. I'm sorry.
I would say a couple things. I agree with pretty much every one of Derek's caveats about overinterpreting this thing, but it was significant that the Republican base was there and turned out. You know, we knew the Democratic base was going to show up, and the Republican base did as well. And in retrospect, it's always easier analyzing the things in retrospect, it was a little bit crazy, the idea that Republican voters in a Republican district in the South were going to vote against maybe an uninspiring but completely acceptable Republican in the form of Karen Handel because they're upset with Trump over something, over his tweets or over the so-called Russian scandal. You know, they showed up and they voted Republican. And I think it was smart of Ossoff to soften his opposition to Trump, because I think the anti-Trump backlash, if it is cast in terms of ousting him from office, is going to create an anti-Trump backlash. And I think that's part of what we saw in the district. But I also think that his milquetoast campaign wasn't really credible, because, you know, you're in that district. Really, you think the progressives around the country are showering $23 million on this guy because they think he's just a polite young man who wants to cut wasteful spending? No, he was a creature of the resistance. And I think if a wave comes, and it still might, you know, candidate quality doesn't matter so much. But in districts like that, it helps if you have someone who plays a little bit against type, you know, former military, former sheriff, or goes against the party orthodoxy on some of these hot button cultural issues, even if it's just a symbolic departure. You know, like Bill Clinton's formulation, abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. Ossoff didn't do any of that, and the National Party and national activists seem to have very little tolerance for that.
Rich, you wrote this thing this week on culture and the idea that Democrats need to make concessions on culture, and I buy instinctively into that idea that that would help pick up votes at the margin. But when you look at the polling on the individual issues you would think of as culture issues, whether that's gay marriage, gun control, even transgender bathroom policies, the polls seem to find more support for the Democratic position than for the Republican position nationally. So I'm having trouble figuring out what operationally the culture gap means. Where is the area that Democrats are more out of touch on culture than Republicans are?
Well, I think it's just generally, one, it's a statement of independence from the National Party at a time when in these kind of districts, Republicans can come in and just say, this guy is going to vote for Nancy Pelosi. He's just one of them like all the rest. And that message cuts. So it's a sign of independence. And two, in a district like that one in Georgia 6, highly educated suburban district, also a lot of evangelicals or swaths of that district that are mega church country. And you just need to give those voters something, I think, a concession that they don't need to hate or fear you, that you understand their cultural concerns. So even if polling on a certain issue says no, you need to go a different way. And just one last point, Katrina, maybe you like this one. I do think Bernie is more onto this than other Democrats. I think the party can go to the left on economic issues. You know, it wouldn't have hurt Ossoff if he'd been in favor of free tuition. But Bernie has been willing to cut Democrats some slack, especially in this Omaha mayoral race that was
And he did in Montana as well, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, listen, I think you're right on some issues, but you know, Ossoff was, as we said at The Nation, I mean, he was an empty suit candidate, so he could be defined. I think you need to define yourself, and you need, you're going to go berserk, Rich, but, you know, in the UK, Corbyn put out a big manifesto, and it allowed him to define itself, and voters wanted to argue about what he was for, not what he was against. And I'm a big believer that you need to go from the resistance to building political power, and to do that, you need to take a chance on inclusive populist tribunes, champions like a Bernie Sanders, who are demanding a mandate for fundamental change, and we're witnessing that down ballot. Check out John Nichols at thenation.com on the resistance goes local.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
There's been a debate in this country, and especially on college campuses for a while now, about whether so-called hate speech is protected by the First Amendment. And there's one institution in America that has this question absolutely right and is a reliable barometer on it, and that's the Supreme Court, which in a decision hitting on this issue this week ruled 8-0 in favor of free speech, saying speech that demeans on the basis of race, ethnicity, gender, religion, age, disability, or any other similar ground is hateful. But the proudest boast of our free speech jurisprudence is that we protect the freedom to express the thought that we hate. It should be posted in every on every college campus in America.
Katrina Vanderhoof.
Remember last year when Trump flew to Indianapolis to stand with Carrier's workers and heralded the Carrier deal as proof he'd lived up to his pledge to protect U.S. jobs? Well, Trump gave Carrier up to $7 million if it continued to employ at least 1,000 people at the facility for 10 years. Now, just the other day, Carrier has announced it's laying off more than 600 employees. They're heading to Mexico, where the minimum wage is $3.90 a day. Trump positioned himself as a champion of American workers. Instead, he's presiding over a corporate betrayal of those very workers.
Derek Thompson.
There's a Republican argument that too much welfare is bad for work ethic, bad for children. But what if it turned out that the opposite was true? Well, two papers in 2015 found that poor children whose mothers had access to prenatal care under Medicaid, they had lower obesity rates, higher high school graduation, higher incomes in adulthood, and they relied less on public assistance as adults. So it's very possible that Medicaid, a program that is absolutely on the chopping block in the Senate right now, does not trap families in poverty in the long term. To the contrary, it might actually help poor children become adults who don't need government support.
For my rant, I have an exciting announcement. For 21 years, Left, Right, and Center has been trying to squeeze our substantive conversations about the week's news into half an hour. And in today's climate, it's getting harder to fit it all in. A lot of you told us to make it an hour. And good news, we're going to be doing that. Starting in 2 weeks on July 7th on KCRW, Left, Right, and Center will be a full hour every week. Be sure to tell your local NPR station that you hope they'll squeeze us in, and tell all your friends to subscribe to our podcast. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Katrina Vandenhoevel, and Derek Thompson. Laura Dine Million produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Let's start the whole thing up.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes, and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.